How do you do, MuggleCast listeners? Domain names from GoDaddy.com are up to 70% less than the competition. Plus, each domain includes free hosting with a website builder, a free blog, complete email, and much more. Plus, as a listener of MuggleCast, enter code RON, that's R-O-N, when you check out, and get your .com domain name for just $6.95 a year. Some restrictions apply. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com.
Today's MuggleCast is also brought to you by Borders. It won't be long before the much-anticipated release of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. Do you have your mind made up about where Severus Snape's loyalties lie? Do you think he'll betray Harry and his friends, or will he help them to triumph over he who must not be named? Find out more about this complex character in the hot new book, The Great Snape Debate, available only at Borders. Remember to reserve Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows at Borders to save 40%.
Because the highlight of Spider-Man 3 was watching the Order of the Phoenix trailer, thank you Zach21 of Philadelphia, this is MuggleCast episode 90 for May 13th, 2007.
Guys, I don't believe it. I'm done with high school.
Who let you out of high school?
I don't know, but they did. Today was my last day ever.
You sound just as excited about it, too. You're like, ooh, yeah, party.
Well, I am, dude. It's high school's done, man. I was just shocked. I can't believe it's over.
Are you going to graduate?
Welcome back to MuggleCast, everybody. Yes, I am graduating, Micah. Next week.
Congratulations.
Next Sunday.
Where's my invitation?
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry, Mikey. It must got lost in the mail, but you're invited.
Okay.
Bye.
I will. I'll just roll on out to the middle of nowhere, and I'll see you.
Oh, be quiet. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Ben Shane.
I'm Kevin Steck.
I am Eric Skull.
I'm Micah Tannenbaum.
And I'm Mikey B.
Let's go to Micah Tannenbaum for a look at this past week's Harry Potter news stories.
Alright, thanks, Ben. The U.S. Harry Potter audiobook narrator is set to play host to Barnes & Noble's Deathly Hallows release party. The event will commence at 10:30 p.m. on July 20th at the Barnes & Noble in Union Square. Dale will discuss how he got the role of narrator, how he creates his characters' voices, and read excerpts from previous Harry Potter books. A new listing on Barnes & Noble's website is promoting an upcoming box set of all 7 Harry Potter novels, due to be released on September 18th. According to Barnes & Noble's website, the books will be enclosed in a cool case that includes a privacy lock and sticker set. The listing price is $195, but Barnes & Noble has a discounted pre-order of $136.50. Film Music Weekly recently conducted an interview with Nicholas Hooper, the man who composed the score for the 5th Harry Potter film. In this interview, Nicholas discusses in detail various themes on the soundtrack. And according to Warner Brothers' new Dumbledore's Army website, the 5th Harry Potter movie will be rated PG-13 in the United States. Order of the Phoenix is the 2nd film in the series to receive this rating. Goblet of Fire was the first. And speaking of Warner Brothers, they confirmed earlier this week that Order of the Phoenix will be released on July 12, 2007 in the UK. That is one day earlier than originally scheduled, and US fans will still have to wait until the 13th to see it in theaters. In addition to the July 12th release in the UK, Yahoo UK has released another Order of the Phoenix trailer that runs 1 minute and 2 seconds long. Unfortunately, there are no new clips. For all the latest news, screenshots, posters, and interviews related to the 5th movie, be sure to head over to MuggleNet.com. Warner Brothers has announced that the popular 20Q game will be released with Harry Potter answers later this year. The game works by asking the player 20 questions. Once all of them are answered, the system tries to guess what person, place, or thing the person is thinking. Radica, the company behind the game, is asking Potter fans to help train the system by visiting their official website and clicking on Harry Potter at the top. Finally, J.K. Rowling updated her site during the week to answer a few frequently asked questions, as well as an update to her Fanside Award. Can we expect more to come? Maybe? That's all the news for this May 13th, 2007 edition of MuggleCast. Happy Mother's Day. Back to the show.
Thank you for that, Micah. Now, we have a little bit of news to discuss. Micah, didn't you have some requests for Joe? You did your little what's bugging you thing? No.
I did.
Did she come through for you?
She did. It was a little bit delayed, though. It was a little delayed, you know. But nonetheless, she did come through. She updated her FAQ section earlier this week, and we got some interesting information out of it.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that information that we did get. Now, we learned that we don't know what Draco's Patronus is, and I don't know if you guys think that's going to be significant or not, but she gave us quite a bit of information about the exact date of Voldemort's birth and the houses that Tonks and Myrtle were in. And by the way, they were in Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw, respectively. So, Micah, was this quite the update you're expecting, or were you wanting a little more?
I was expecting a little bit more. I mean, I don't know if these are pressing questions. I mean, even the one that she answered concerning Draco's wand, I mean, who cares, honestly? Do you guys care?
I care.
Come
dude,
on.
Dude, I care.
No. I don't think it's... Yeah. Mike makes a good point, though. It's not exactly...
Like
imperative information. It's not imperative, but it's...
It's interesting.
I don't know. But,
it's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not like great stuff, juicy stuff that we want.
But we're not going to get it. We're not going to get that stuff. We're not going to get the juicy... You know, I mean, Micah begged her, said that if he could, he was going to get down on his hands and knees to make, you know, her update her site. And so she did, but now you guys want even more. She's a busy woman. Come on, guys.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know,
a good
she's
point,
working
Eric.
Hard on that Harry Potter book. I mean, she's done.
Exactly.
No, she's still editing.
I just want to know.
She's still editing.
Well, no, the editing is gone. The editing's over because they have a page count. But,
oh, that's true.
Yeah. That's a good point, too. Yeah.
I don't think it's about her being busy.
She's done.
I think it's just like we were saying before, she doesn't want to give anything away. She's.
Well, I guess, guys, we'll just have to wait ourselves, you know.
See, but I don't agree with that.
Was it 71 what? Days?
Yeah, just a whole 71 days and then find out all this information that without reading on her website. I don't know. I think it's interesting stuff to know, and like Eric says, we're not going to get any real juicy stuff.
She tried a little bit, though. She tried messing around with us with the whole invisibility cloak question that she posted.
Oh, wait,
so
what was that?
When she asked why, was it Dumbledore had James's invisibility cloak the night that Voldemort was in Godric's Hollow?
Oh, was this a recent update?
This was a while ago.
We discussed this, though. Discussed this months ago.
Because I thought it was months ago, so I wasn't sure. But what were you trying to say, Micah? Was that... Oh, that's when she kind of tested the water wise.
Yeah, I mean, she can mess around with us if she wanted to. I mean, we're still expecting a couple of updates before the book, right? I mean, she does generally do that kind of thing.
Well, speaking of which, Micah, how long is this mini-update she did now going to hold you over for? When are you going to need some... Some more updates, huh?
Oh, I was ready after I read it. I mean, come on.
Oh, wow. Well, Micah,
Hold on. We'll save a what's bugging Micah for another day. But right now we have some announcements to get to. Vote for us on Podcast Alley. I don't know where we're at right now. Let me take a look-see here. I'll type it into my Firefox here to see what we're ranked.
We're third.
Loading. Okay, right now we're number 3. Number 3 behind Keith and the Girl and Free Talk Live. So go vote for us. We are the only Harry Potter podcast in the top 10. Thank you for making us the number 1 Harry Potter podcast that you listen to. It's awesome. We love you guys. So go vote for us there some more. Let's see here. Oh, how could I forget? I'm so silly. This summer, there is a lot going on with MuggleNet and MuggleCast. I want each and every one of you to be there for the ride. Now, we have Enlightening 2007. Micah, what are the dates for that?
They are, I believe, July 12th through the 15th. I should just double check on that. But I know we're doing the podcast the night of the 12th, right? Thursday, July 12th?
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. So, yeah, we have Enlightening, where Andrew, Micah, and myself will be there. And we can discuss things with us, have a good time, come out and have a good time. Then we have Prophecy 2007, another convention this time. This one is in Toronto, Canada. And we're actually going to be having the podcast at midnight, so come out and see us there. The next event we're going, you can find us at is the U.S. premiere and the U.K. premiere. The U.S. premiere is held on the 8th of July, is that correct?
Yeah.
On the 8th of July, and the U.K. premiere is on, when is it, guys? Do you know?
July 3rd.
On the 3rd of July. So, yeah, we're going to have shows then, so you can come out and mingle with the Mugglecasters. That'll be a good time. And right now we're talking about doing some possible other shows around the country. It just really depends on what exactly we're doing. So hopefully that works out, all works out. You can find all the full details on our summer's tour schedule coming up on the Mugglecast website. Another thing, Mugglecast fans, listen here. If you're the hardcore Mugglecast fan, if you're the number one Mugglecast fan, if you're going to be the Mugglecast fan who's at Prophecy, who's at Enlightening, who's at the premieres, who's at all of our live shows, then we have the thing just for you, don't we, Micah?
Yes, we do.
Pickle Pack. It's been released for 2 weeks now. We have a bunch of members, but we're always in the need of more. It's for the hardcore Mugglecast fan only. It's your home to bonus audio, videos, pictures, secret show info, and much, much more. Registration is only open until June 16th. Remember that. June 16th is the last day we're taking signups. We don't even know if we're going to open them again. It will at least be a year if we do open signups again. So today is your last chance to sign up. So please hurry and sign up today.
I'm a member.
Mikey's always me. Yeah, Mikey's a member.
I love it.
Mikey was one of our first members. So Mikey, he loves the Pickle Pack.
So, Mikey, are you pleased with what you've received so far?
Of course. I'm waiting for my T-shirt to come in. You know, I'm excited. I got to see all the Bickles and
Blickles.
I think the name is amazing. The Blickles are amazing. Jamie and Ben's and Andrew's. I love it. I'm a proud member.
One final announcement here. Go ahead and pick up our book, MuggleNet.com's What Will Happen in Harry Potter 7. The success for this book has been mind-blowing, to say the least. It's been incredible how many sales we've gotten, how much media coverage we've gotten over this thing. Our book, it's up to number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list this week. According to Nielsen BookScan, it's the 58th overall best-selling book in the country, the 14th best-selling paperback, and the 4th best-selling children's book, and the 1st best-selling children's nonfiction book. So, thank you. Thanks to everybody. This is all because of all of you, everyone who has bought the book. Remember, you can order it online through our online retailer known as Olivons. Olivons.com is selling the book. You can order it through there and support the site and the show. So please do that if you haven't yet. It'll help you. It'll help hold you over these last 70 days until we finally get our hands on Book 7. So
no mention of the tour, of the book tour, Ben.
Yes. Oh yeah. Good point, Mikey. We're going to be on tour. Visit mugglenet.com/booktour.shtml. You can find all of our dates. We're going to be in California. Then we're going to be in Ohio, Portland, Maine, New York, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, all of these places, Connecticut. We're going to be all over promoting the book. You can come out and meet us. And we'll have a good time. So
it should be fun, right, Ben?
Yeah, it's going to be a great time. Mikey's actually the driver while we're in California. So if you want to meet the Mikey B, the Mikey Bouchereau,
wait, yes,
come out and see us.
Mikey, you're not going to be the driver in Portland? Not in
no,
Portland?
No, no. I just wanted to be California. That's it. California.
But not,
that's
not
my home
not,
state.
Yeah. Okay, so not in
Mikey's
Portland.
I'm the California contact.
Yeah.
I guess. Oh, no. So what's up next, guys?
Well, we have some rebuttals this week. Some people who had a problem with what we said on last week's show. I'm just kidding. Some people may have some disagreements here. Our first email comes from Bruce, age 17, of New York, and he's talking about the music for Order of the Phoenix. Quote, "Hey, Mugglecasters, I was listening to episode 88 today and was interested in your brief discussion on the Order of the Phoenix music. Andrew mistakenly states Peter Doyle is the composer for the new film, when in fact, IMDb.com says Nicholas Hooper has composed the music for Order of the Phoenix, and Patrick Doyle was the composer for Goblet of Fire. Whoops, Andrew. He says, "No worries, Andrew. Everyone makes mistakes, but I'm still a bit disappointed that John Williams has not composed the newest HP movie soundtrack.
Yeah.
Should I just be content with the fantastic legacy he's already left on the Harry Potter world?
Yes.
Love the show.
Yes.
End quote.
You should be.
I don't know. I've never really had an opinion on the composers because I've listened to, you know, you hear the music in the movie, and I always think that's good, but I've never really purchased the soundtrack and listened to it fully. So I know, terrible fan. What about you? What do you guys think?
I think they should just be satisfied with the work that has already been done. I mean, it's not likely John Williams is coming back, so, you know, he set the stage for the other composers, and they've built upon his work.
Yeah, I think John Williams did a fantastic job. But
yeah, it was a great foundation.
Right, and so. I think that...
was there a reason...
Patrick Doyle and Nicholas Hooper are probably... Patrick Doyle, I enjoyed the music in Goblet of Fire. I thought it was great. I think Hooper's likely to do the same. I don't think we're going to be disappointed with the soundtrack, so...
I don't think there was a reason, Mikey. I don't think they ever say a reason why John Williams left. Probably just for his own reasons, John Williams.
Yeah,
you know?
He might just want to move on, you know?
It could have been, you know, cost. It could have been... him just wanting to move
on,
stuff like
things,
that.
Really.
We don't know. But, I mean, either way, just because it's John Williams doesn't... or just because it's not John Williams doesn't mean that we're not going to get great music.
Oh, no, and that's why they can still...
true.
That's why they can still have the rights to the to Hedwig's theme and stuff like that, you know. And once John Williams came in and created the world out of it and come up with the, you know, he has the several different underlying kind of musical
themes,
scores.
Yeah.
Yeah, themes that just get, you know, not recycled and recycled, but reinvented throughout all the movies that he does. And so when he left in three, I thought that Prisoner of Azkaban's score was like vastly new. Like, I mean, Chamber of Secrets was too, just like Chamber of Secrets was before that. But he left with quite a good few things just to possibly for other composers to take off of. And just the fact
definitely.
You know, and so the rights of the film, et cetera, that allow other composers to do Hedwig's theme, I mean, that's all you really need, Hedwig's theme, in a Harry Potter movie.
Yeah, it's the main one.
And because of the... Well, sorry, I'm just going to finish up here. I just think that the movies now, 4 and 5 and stuff, have been... done in a certain way where the music does enhance the plot, but it's not as mystical, I guess, as the previous movies were. You know, I wouldn't say they relied on the music, but there's just different movies where it doesn't really call for all these different themes. Like Umbridge can have her own theme and stuff, but it's just not. I'm not paying attention to music as much as I used to.
Yeah, good point, Eric.
There was actually a reason, and I was searching online because I remember one of my film music teachers telling me about this, why he didn't continue on. I found it online. He was actually contracted to George Lucas and Steven Spielberg for their films at the time of Goblet of Fire. That's why he wasn't able to work with Warner Brothers on the new Harry Potter film. He was doing War of the Worlds for Spielberg, and he was doing... Star Wars Revenge of the Sith with George Lucas.
Oh my gosh.
Both great movies, and, both great music.
So, but he was, you know, obviously they went with Patrick Doyle. I think the music was really good. So obviously they didn't lose out too much, you know, like you said. So Williams made the world with the music, and it's just continued on. I don't know if there was another reason why he couldn't do it, you know, this one, but...
Right, but we have some more rebuttals to get to here. Chris, age 20, from Missouri, writes... He wants to discuss Voldemort's red eyes, by the way. And he writes, quote, "Hello, MuggleCast. I am a relatively new listener, and I really enjoy your show. I have a response about the question of why Voldemort has red eyes. I remember watching an interview slash behind the scenes that I believe it was the director who said they decided to change Voldemort's red eyes because on film, red or dark eyes do not express emotion as well, and they thought with blue eyes that they could really display Voldemort's emotions and expressions a lot better. Sorry this is kind of a broad answer, but that is all I can remember. I currently don't have access to the copy of The Goblet of Fire to recall the details. I hope this helps. All you guys are very entertaining. Keep it going. Chris."
A number of people wrote in saying that Heyman actually talked about
true.
That. Yeah, on the behind the scenes of the Goblet of Fire DVD. Basically what this guy is saying, sorry, I forgot his name, Chris. What Chris was saying is accurate, that he didn't feel that Voldemort's character could be portrayed the right way. You couldn't see sort of the emotion in his eyes. So that's why they decided not to make them red, not because they would scare little children, like we said on last week's show.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I was pretty convinced that it's not because of scaring little children. I just didn't. I wasn't aware that David Heyman had said this.
Oh. Well, it's like
I was corrected there. I thought it would scare children, but you know.
Oh. Well, no. I mean,
it would have scared me. It would have scared me. So
Yeah, but Mikey, you get scared by.
I get scared by vacuum cleaners too, just like Andrew's brother. So,
just like cats, Mikey, you're a cat. But no, you can go up to Voldemort now and say, "Hey, you're so full of anger and hate that your eyes are blue."
Yeah.
Anyway, he's blue with anger.
He's blue with anger.
Behind these hazel eyes.
Hey, thanks, Eric. Thanks. Yeah. We have one final rebuttal this week from Karen, age 23, from Fargo, North Dakota. Hey, guys, fun show tonight. After listening to you, I was looking at the clips on YouTube and came across those ABC specials from Order of the Phoenix. Remember those clips that were like 30 seconds apiece and they had one for Bellatrix, the DA, the director, etc.? Well, the clip for the Order seems to answer the question you got by one of the Pickle Pack. When she asked what piece of paper, a.k.a. the love note from Cho, Sirius was holding when talking to Harry at the train station. Well, in the clip, you hear Sirius say, "That's the original Order." So it appears he is showing that the pick that Moody showed Harry in the book. Makes sense, since we know Sirius also says, "It's your turn now, Harry," in that scene. I thought I'd pass that one. Back to studying for my final. Take care. Karen. End quote.
She's linking
so one. Here, exactly.
Last week we talked about that picture with Sirius at the train station with a scroll. We had no clue what it was. It's the picture of the Order.
Oh, okay. So she's
pointing something out that we missed.
Thanks, Karen, for clarifying that. Well, that wraps up this week's listener rebuttals. Remember, if you have any problems with what we say on the show, if some information is not factual, or you have an opinion that does not agree with ours, go ahead and send us an email telling us why you disagree with us to mugglecast@staff.mugglenet.com. Or if you want to attack one of us personally, you can email our first name at staff.mugglenet.com.
And it's a good thing.
And we'll gladly reply to you. Huh. So, well, it's time to move on to this week's main discussion, where we're going to be discussing that symbol. You know what symbol I'm talking about. You all know what symbol I'm talking about. Don't they, Micah?
I hope so. Otherwise, this will be a very short discussion.
Yeah. So to figure out what we're talking about here, go to bloomsbury.com/Harry Potter. And it's the symbol we're talking about is now the centerpiece of Bloomsbury's website. So, Micah, do you want to do a little explaining here?
Yeah, I mean, I think when the covers first came out, we looked at the spine of the UK children's edition, and we were kind of wondering what that symbol was. And I know we came up with a couple of different ideas here and there, and we weren't really sure, well, was it just some Bloomsbury print logo that they happened to put on there for the final book? And we looked at some of the other past UK children's editions and saw that there were some pretty significant symbols that were on the binding. So I think now that Bloomsbury has taken it and thrown it in the middle of their site, we can be pretty certain that this is pretty important in the final book.
Right. And what's interesting is that whoever the illustrator is for the UK editions, I'm not familiar with who they are, they decided to take a different approach on making the cover, which they do with every book, of course. But if this is something that's really pivotal in a way, if it's key, if it's an important symbol, what's interesting is that it isn't on the American cover. So Mary Grand Prix must not have thought it was that important, I guess. I don't know. Do you guys have anything to say about that?
I don't think necessarily it wasn't that important. It's just that she didn't want to include it in her cover. You know, she chooses what she wants and what she thinks is interesting.
Right, but if we're saying that what's on the Bloomsbury cover, the symbol, if it's a significant symbol, you know, if it's something that pivotal, then why wouldn't it make the cover?
Well, it's just because she chose covers. Yeah, because wow. She chose a more, or maybe not more pivotal, but just another important scene from the book that she wanted to portray. I mean, for all you know, that symbol is written on a door, and she didn't want to paint a door.
Well, I guess it's true that, well, don't you remember with Half-Blood Prince when there was the ring on the spine? Wasn't that right?
That was on the UK version.
Right.
Yeah, on the UK edition, just like this. So, and that wasn't on the US edition.
So.
I don't believe so. So I guess there are, if you look to the past, there have always been, you know, a little bit of difference between what they decided, what's seen. I guess it's always been different.
Well,
but.
We haven't seen the inside flaps, though, have we, of the U.S. edition?
No, we haven't.
Yeah, we
Well,
haven't we seen the full artwork, though?
We have seen the full artwork, but I think you're referring, like Mike is referring to, with their added text and, you know, sometimes they add extra images in there, too. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think Mary Grand Prix was going for a very basic, not trying to give much away, whereas this UK edition, I mean, even putting the symbol aside, has so much more on it than the American edition.
And Bloomsbury has said that it does play a significant role, so that's not up in the question. It's just, what role does it play? I mean, I'm sure there's somebody out there who's studied ancient runes or something that could tell us what the symbol means. So if you have any idea what the symbol represents, please email us.
So Bloomsbury said it was important?
Yes.
Yes.
It's also on their website. Have you gone to their site recently?
If you go to bloomsbury.com/Harry Potter, you go to the site and there's this, is it a piece of chalk or something that just goes, scrapes across the screen and goes... to this, like,
wait,
this,
you forgot the circle part and the line.
And the circle and then the line that goes up. And I thought it was being slashed. I thought the new Zorro movie was coming out. But no, it's just this sign, this symbol for America Online that just keeps haunting all of us.
You know,
yeah.
I'm wondering if, because it looks like you said, chalk. What if it's like in stone? Maybe that's Dumbledore stone that it's being written in because it's
or
white.
Be written in runes.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know.
Well, but it's being written on something that's kind of white. And I'm looking at the cover right now, and it's the same. What's on the website is the same this little section on the book cover also. The same weird white section. So.
We'll see.
I don't know.
We're having trouble here coming up with any explanation for what this symbol means. So let's get a few listener thoughts on the subject. Jeremy18 from Sydney, from Down Under, writes...
Ben, that was
I've heard a lot
good.
Of people think. Was it? Thank you. I've heard a lot of people thinking that the spinal horn on Deathly Hallows may be part of the Key of Solomon. The Key of Solomon is a book on magic attributed to King Solomon. It is divided into two books and contains the conjurations to summon spirits of the dead, spirits from hell, and how to protect the conjurer. The book has many magical circles in that it is usually a type of symbol made up of circles and magic. In the past two books, the spine art has been very relevant and possibly even a minor cause of the deaths at the end of each book. Sirius died working for the Order of the Phoenix, and in part Dumbledore died because he weakened himself twice for Horcruxes, or at least Harry thinks he did. So what do you guys think? I'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks, Jeremy. End quote.
Hmm. Yeah. See, the problem with the symbol is that at this time it can mean anything. You know what I mean? We have absolutely no basis of where she's linking this symbol in history or in runes. So I could probably, you know, you could probably find 100 different meanings of the same symbol.
Well, this book that they're talking about reminds me of the Book of the Dead in, I think it's what it's called, in The Mummy.
Yeah, The Mummy.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about that. It's the book, it's a golden book of Amun-Ra.
Yeah, that's it. And it has basically all these things, how to summon spirits of the dead, spirits from hell, and how they kill the mummy at the end.
Well, I like that. I like it because a lot of our discussion about Deathly Hallows was about the day where the veil is the thinnest between the world of the living and dead, so... Perhaps this is how it's somehow tied to it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So, do you think that this indicates that? So, okay, since Harry and Voldemort really can't duel, and if Harry wants to eventually defeat Voldemort, we all pretty much agree that he will kill Voldemort. Do you think that the fact that this is a ancient symbol or something, do you think that can indicate that Harry's going to have to discover some form of ancient magic in order to defeat Voldemort?
Well, Ben, the Book of Amun-Ra, the character Imhotep's last line in the movie is, death is only the beginning, and death was at the very beginning of our Harry Potter series.
So, yeah, I guess that's true. So, I don't know. But Rob Cheeseman, he knows something. He writes, he's from 23 and he's from Liverpool, England. He writes, is it me or does Ron have Godric Gryffindor's sword in his hand? More importantly, why? Regarding the delta image, delta in mathematics is used to denote difference between, or change in, things. If the other symbol is indeed phi, then perhaps the image is being used to denote a change in wisdom. As for phi, the number to which you refer in the golden ratio, which is intimately related to the nature and aesthetically pleasing things, including Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. Incidentally, the Great Pyramid at Giza is proposed to be closely related to the golden ratio. More evidence for an Egyptian adventure? It was also described by Johannes Kepler as a precious jewel. Significant? Not entirely sure of the significance of all of this, but I'm sure it'll make for good discussion.
More Egypt.
Before we go into Delta Phi, I was actually reading, we have another one. Actually, the next message, the next caller talks about Delta Phi specifically. So why don't we hold off that
ahead,
one?
We'll go ahead and read.
Or do you want to read that one?
We'll go ahead and read that. Robin, 45, from Santa Rosa, California, writes specifically about Delta Phi. She, quote, "I had an idea about what the symbol of the spine of the UK children's edition Deathly Hallows cover might be. I was thinking that in Greek, maybe the letters Delta and Phi might be the abbreviation of Order of the Phoenix. I went to Babelfish and did an English to Greek translation of order, and the word that came up began with a Delta. I put in Phoenix, and the word that came up did begin with a Phi. Pretty neat, huh? What do you think?"
That'd be pretty interesting.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems almost like too much of a coincidence for me.
Yeah. And you know what the symbols for delta and phi are, right? Delta is
of course,
a triangle,
yeah.
And phi is a circle with a line through it. So, kind of the symbol here. I don't
phi
know.
Phi is typically capped, though, like an I instead of a line.
Yeah, it's like an
line.
I instead of a line.
Capital I.
I don't know if I you know, that's a cool coincidence. I don't know if that is actually what the symbol means.
Well, Mikey, though, you were talking before, though, that this symbol was very similar to sort of the white marble on Dumbledore's tomb. Isn't that what you were going for before?
Yeah, well, it seems so, like it, you know, it's on white, so it would make sense. I don't know.
It would make sense, then, if it was a symbol for the Order of the Phoenix.
Right, if it is, yeah, if it is on Dumbledore's tomb, but why would it be significant if it was on Dumbledore's tomb? That's the thing.
Well,
I guess if Dumbledore, I don't know.
The Order of the Phoenix
has to be significant.
This book is going to be the death of me, I'll never know. I'm honestly, like, my brain right now hurts because I'm trying to answer these questions logically, but
yeah.
There's so much, like, I don't know, like, what could it mean?
Before we get ahead of ourselves here, Daniel 19 from Armagh. So someone's going to get mad and correct me. Ireland. Armagh. Just email me and tell me how it's really pronounced.
Right.
Has a little bit of information about... Has the question and little information about Dumbledore's tomb. "Hi, all you MuggleCasters. I love the show and can't get enough of your cover coverage. Quote, let's get to it. In one of the previous episodes, 80-something, can't remember which one exactly, you talked about the odd symbol on the top of the spine of the UK children's cover. And I noticed that when you look closer, the background for the symbol, it appears to be marbled. Now, when I realized this, I tried to remember any time the marble is mentioned, and I came up with Gringotts, which we can eliminate it, I think, because it is described in the book as being snowy white, not really marble, and Dumbledore's tomb. So I think the symbol on the spine could be some sort of symbol on Dumbledore's tomb that might be recognized and translated by, say, someone who has been studying ancient runes for the past 3 years. No idea formulated about what it could mean yet, but just an interesting point." Who's been studying ancient runes?
Hermione.
Yeah. So, yeah, mark my words, that's probably going to play a role, Hermione's knowledge in ancient runes.
Oh, wow. I just
realized,
I was looking up, I'm on Wikipedia and I searched for marble, and there's a term called fox marbling, or faux marbling, marbling, whatever, and it's a wall painting technique. Faux, yeah, that's what it is. So, but I saw fox and I was like, holy crap, but no, never mind.
How are you like? What were you doing?
I'm looking up marble and trying to see.
Are you redecorating?
Marble is a metamorphic rock. No, I was just on Wikipedia. Marble is a metamorphic rock resulting from regional or rarely contact metamorphism of sedimentary carbonate rocks, either limestone or dolostone. The metamorphic processes causes a complete... So this is why I'm not taking geography or geology. Geology. This is why I'm not a geologist. Never mind. I thought I'd find something. But Joe, no, but speaking about marble, though, Joe did talk about alchemy. in the first book, you know, the Philosopher's Stone. And Dumbledore did some work on alchemy with Nicholas Flamel. I'm wondering if alchemy itself will come into play in the future books.
Future book, you mean? There's only one.
All right, yeah, crap. Oh, yeah. Future book. Future 700 and, or 800 some pages, yeah.
I don't know, but the symbol is what's important right now, and I don't
think these are a lot of good ideas, and I think they've raised just a whole lot more questions.
Yeah, it's true. And like I said before, we have no basis for what it's linked to, so it could be linked to anything in history. Or it could be, like I saw an email recently that said it's a triangle which represents the trio, and a circle which represents unity, and a line down the middle which represents a breaking of this unity.
Right, you know, and
that was a completely interpreted response to the symbol that could be absolutely correct.
Yeah, and we have an email about that from Jared Pratt from 20 from Canandaigua, New York. Correct me on that too. Quote: He says, "Hey, MuggleCasters." Is that right?
Yeah, Canandaigua.
Canandaigua.
Upstate New York, yeah.
Winnebago?
Okay. Indian territory. Native American, Native American territory.
Okay. Quote, "Hey, MuggleCasters, I heard about this symbol in episode 85 and promptly turned to my copy of the Book of Signs by Rudolf Koch. After examining the picture of the UK cover and analyzing the symbol through the compendium, is that right? Compendium of symbols, I have come to this conclusion. This is a compound signet comprised of two elemental symbols, the vertical split circle, which stands for God's vision of light from darkness and or time, and the vertically split equilateral triangle means a broken trinity or loss of faith. This is purely academic view, as my amateur analysis can reveal. I'd love to hear what you guys have to say on this." End quote. Thanks for that,
Jared. And like I said before, I mean, it's
so many questions.
It's completely plausible. You know, it's absolutely plausible that's what it's going to be. But until we get at least some bit of information as to where it links, whether it be Greek or, you know, this Book of Signs, we won't have any idea exactly what it is. I think it could absolutely be correct. Yeah.
But his interpretation, Jared's interpretation here about it, well, yeah, and I think even if this is not specifically what the symbol was referencing in Half-Blood Prince, I think that his interpretation could mean, the symbol could have more than one meaning, because, you know, he said, talks about an equilateral triangle, a split equilateral triangle, meaning a broken trinity or loss of faith. Well, that would make sense, because as they have this time of war going on and stuff, a lot of people may start to lose faith in the cause on both sides. You know, they may lose faith in the fact that thinking that things are going to work themselves out. So when there's despair going on, when there's war going on, you know, it does make sense for there to be a loss in faith, even if that symbol isn't referring to that.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
specifically,
we learned about, I mean, Half-Blood Prince is the name that Snape called himself. Maybe Draco goes around calling himself this. Like, maybe took a leaf out of Prince's book, you know?
Just, the wizard formerly known as Draco Malfoy?
Yeah. So now he's Phi Delta or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Delta Phi.
That'd be funny. Well,
what do you guys think?
Well, that wraps up this week's main discussion.
Yep.
We're sorry we can't offer anything that isn't really anything more than conjecture, but we haven't read the book yet, so we don't know what's going on.
Well, I have, but...
right, Mike. Well, hopefully this gives each of you a few ideas as to what to expect or what it could possibly be, and that's the best we can do. If you have any rebuttals of this or any emails or any thoughts that we have missed in the show, please email us at mugglecast@staff.mugglenet.com. Now, we have a few voicemails this week about stuff other than analyzing the cover, well, overanalyzing the cover like we love to do. So we have a few voicemails for you here this week, and let's roll the first one.
Hey, MuggleCasters, this is Wesley from California. Your show is fantastic. I just started listening to it about a week ago, and now you guys have me completely addicted. Anyways, my question is this. From what I can tell, you guys seem to have concluded that Harry will not be able to kill Voldemort as long as Voldemort still has a wand with the same phoenix feather as Harry's. Because if Harry tries to do the Avada Kedavra on Voldemort, Priori Incantatum will just keep blocking it. Although this is logical, in the Goblet of Fire, Voldemort still performs the Cruciatus Curse on Harry, even while Harry has his wand drawn. I think this was because Harry wasn't performing a spell at that exact same time, so Priority Cantatum didn't block it. Doesn't this mean that Harry could actually kill Voldemort, as long as Voldemort wasn't doing a spell at the exact same time? What do you guys think? Thanks. Bye.
The person makes a very interesting point, and I think Harry can kill Voldemort as long as Voldemort doesn't shoot up any type of curse so to create the Priori Incantatum. So they can't duel and can't shoot spells at each other at the same time, but they can put spells on each other. So, but everything would be all too easy to block. That's the thing.
All you had to do is shout out any
random spell
that
right.
comes to... Yeah.
Because what saved Harry? It was Expelliarmus, so...
Yeah. No. I think it's going to come down to something beyond... I think either one of them is going to lose their wand or, you know, something unique. It's not going to be wand on wand.
You know, I have a question about that. Maybe you guys know. Is it that, you know, if they were able to just toss out anything, you know, wouldn't, you know, Harry's, you know, shield charm or shield spell, you know, backfire Voldemort's Avada Kedavra then because they're technically connecting? Or is it that the spell has left the wand and now it's no longer connected? How does Prior Incantatum actually
I think
work?
The wand's just is link. The, it completely nullifies yeah, just, whatever spell you were casting and just links the wands.
Yeah, but it's not that a shield charm cast by Harry's wand would deflect something or cause a problem for Voldemort's wand. I just think it's when the wands are directly faced with each other.
Yeah, I don't think
basically
the spell matters.
Exactly anything that comes out of the wand is nullified by the fact that the
right.
two wands are brother wands.
Brother wands, and they can't fight each other. So
they connect somehow.
This could be interesting for on the cover of the American edition of Deathly Hallows. If they're both reaching for a wand, maybe Harry is reaching for it. And
yeah,
Voldemort's
I've seen
to push
someone.
It away.
Someone sent that in at one point, and I thought it was pretty interesting. Where it comes
well,
down
already,
to just a single yeah. wand between the two of them, and whoever gets a wand first is going to, you know, win. That would be pretty interesting.
Well, it's what I like about Star Wars is that when they're lightsaber dueling, some of the coolest stuff happens without the lightsabers. I mean, lightsabers are cool, but they'll also punch each other, or their lightsaber will get cut in half, or they'll lose it, and they'll have to go hand-to-hand combat or jumping and you rely on everything else. You know, it's not just strictly lightsaber battles. It's actually just, you know, hand-to-hand combat and face-to-face and really battle of the wits and, you know, everything else.
Well, guys, how athletic is Voldemort? How do you think Voldemort would handle hand-to-hand combat?
Yeah, I don't think
he'd have to
so
use
either.
It, really, would he? Because he could just use wandless magic. He wouldn't even need
yeah.
his wand.
Well, it's not exactly like you could test Harry and Voldemort to run the mile, either, now that they can just apparate.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Who can apparate the quickest?
So to answer your question, I don't know how physically fit they are.
I don't think it matters. See, that's the beauty of the Wizarding World. You don't have to be... to be a good wizard, you don't have to be buff. You don't have to be thin.
You can have treacle tart and pumpkin pasties all day long and just apparate to work and never be late, never be fit.
Yeah.
Seriously, obesity must be a big problem. Because imagine if you don't have to walk anywhere. Actually, but you could probably just zap the fat right off. There's probably some weight loss potion. Oh man, I wish I lived in that world.
Ben, I think you just titled the show.
Yeah. What?
Zap the fat right off.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Thank you for that voicemail. We have another one here. Go ahead and roll the clip.
Hey, MuggleCats. I was reading Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone to my two younger sisters, and I came upon this quote in the hardback edition of the U.S. Book. On page 8, it said, "Nothing like this man has ever been seen on Pivot Drive, of course, referring to Albus Dumbledore." This made me think, during that missing 24 hours of the Potter's death and where the book picked up, do you think Dumbledore talked to Aunt Petunia about her sister's death somewhere else in Pivot Drive? If you think, if so, where? I would love to, I love your show. Bye. Pickle.
That really sounds like pure conjecture to me. I don't, It's not unlikely, but I don't know. That was the purpose of the letter, I think. I don't think a letter would have been left if they had already met and discussed these things.
Yeah, it was to explain the situation.
I think it's just setting the tone for the book. I mean, you know, it's supposed to be taking out of just the sort of mundane style of life that these people normally have and just...
Yeah, it's supposed to be mysterious and...
Yeah, it sets up who Dumbledore is, too.
Yeah, and... there wouldn't be as much of... I mean, okay, imagine if you're Petunia and Vernon and a baby's just on your doorstep. What can you do? You know, imagine how cruel... I mean, I know they're cruel people, but I don't think they're viciously cruel to the point where they wouldn't even... You know, if someone drops a baby off on my doorstep, I'm going to take care of it until I can turn it over to the proper authorities or whatever, you know? So, I think that they're really... I really doubt that there was a prior meeting to...
Yeah, I'm fairly sure it was the. I'm fairly sure it's the letter that set everything up.
Yeah, thanks for that voicemail. Our next voicemail comes from two girls from Los Angeles, California.
Hi, I'm Audrey Kaufman,
and I'm Quentin,
and we're two 11-year-old MuggleCast fans from Los Angeles, California.
Our fear is that Harry will die in Deathly Hallows because when he encountered the Mirror of Erised, his heart's desire was to be with his family, and dying would certainly make that happen.
We thought that the book would culminate in a big battle between Harry and Voldemort in which they both die. That way, it would be sad because Harry dies and happy because Harry sees his family again and Voldemort dies too.
Joe could suit the ending to many different takes. It would be totally an awesome way to end the series. We think it's a probable theory and we want to know what you guys think.
Keep up the good work. Bye!
I thought we have always talked on the show about how your desire changes, and I think that when Harry is so young, that is his desire to be with his family, but I think if he looked in the mirror now, it would be a completely different picture. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that makes sense, that his ultimate desire has changed, and I think that he wants... saving the wizarding world is now more important to him than being with his family, because Harry isn't a selfish person. He's going to put the needs of the needs of the many are going to outweigh the needs of himself. So,
yeah. Well, I think it goes back to the Mirror of Erised, and if you believe that it will actually show what's true, because Dumbledore said it didn't show truth, nor knowledge, nor anything else
future,
like that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, or the future, yeah. But at the same time, Ron has since become head boy and won the Quidditch Cup and done all the crap that he saw in the mirror, or done all the stuff that he saw in the Mirror of Erised. So I don't know what to think about the Mirror of Erised anymore, because what Ron saw came true. So
Right. But that doesn't mean that it's all of a sudden it's prophetic.
Right.
That's even a word. Is that a word?
Yeah, it is.
It's not like it doesn't mean that does not mean that the mirror is predicting these things, because if you think about it, some people have their greatest desires in life come true at times,
Ron has always had a confidence problem, and what better to boost his confidence than seeing that, you know, his desire as, you know, seeing himself as the Quidditch champion. You know, it could have just been the fact that seeing it motivated him to try to be what he desired.
Because once he saw himself, then he realized, I can do this. He realized the potential, maybe. So,
you know, I don't think Ron was really aiming that high to where his dreams were out of, his most desires were out of his reach. You know, being head boy and Quidditch
captain.
Well,
at the time, they seemed a bit extreme, because he wasn't even on the Quidditch team. He was this first year who didn't...
Bloody hell, Harry.
Hold on a second. Has Ron became head boy?
No, We don't know seven yet.
Has Ron become head boy?
No, he's not Quidditch captain
either.
He's
been a prefect.
He's getting close.
He's been a prefect.
He's getting close to his goal,
He's getting
He's
very
on
close.
The Quidditch team. He's a prefect, but he's not there
Weasley
yet.
Is our king.
So there you go. He didn't even achieve his goals.
Yeah.
Well, he came pretty darn close.
And he's not coming back to school for year seven. He's going on the hunt for the Horcrux. So he's not getting that.
According to Mikey.
Was he not in book six holding the Quidditch cup after he blocked all of the goals against Slytherin or something?
Yeah, except for the whole point to that was so Harry and Ginny can get their Mac on.
Well, okay, so they can get their Mac.
I'm trying to keep it nice and, you know, PG rated here. I don't know. Like, honestly, seriously, I don't know about the Mirror Air set. I don't think it means that much. I think we're looking way too much into it.
No, I don't agree that it shows much. I mean, I don't think it does, is what I was trying to say.
Well, I still think that his desire, at least on Harry's side, his desires have definitely changed, and it's not to be with his parents anymore, I don't think. When he was young, definitely. When he's only 11 years old, then I'm sure after everything he's been through that's what he wants more than anything else.
He just needs someone to love. Someone to be loved.
But I don't think that foreshadows Harry dying, because I think in Sorcerer's Stone, and so many people have sent this in, and I don't know if we talked about it, but there's a quote in page 262 of Sorcerer's Stone, and it says, "In years to come, Harry would never quite remember how he managed to get through his exams when he half expected Voldemort to come bursting through the door at any moment."
Yeah, you know what? That's cool. I don't recall if we ever talked about that, Micah, but I remember reading that.
So in years to come, I mean, that to me signifies much more than just a couple years down the road.
Yeah, me too, because during years 2 through 6, as we've seen, Harry's not exactly thinking in depth about exam week in year 1. You know what I'm saying? So that J.K. put this, in years to come, Harry would never quite know, you know, how he got through exams in year 1. Well, when do we see? We don't see him thinking about that, so it's possible, and it's very possible that...
Can he never
survives.
Quite remember because he dies, or does he never quite remember because...
Yeah, in years to come, Harry would never quite reflect on the task of him.
But if you're a supporter of Harry living, then that's definitely a quote that works in your favor, I think.
It's pretty good.
Well, thanks for that voicemail. We have another one here from Emma from Australia.
Hi, MuggleCast. This is Emma, 17, from Victoria in Australia. I'm submitting a theory about how Book 7 will finally end. My theory is that Harry will go back to Godric's Hollow, as he said in Half-Blood Prince, and then he will journey with Ron and Hermione to find the Horrocruxes. Harry will then lead Voldemort to Godric's Hollow and fight and try to destroy the final one of the Dark Lord's soul, which is Voldemort himself. I have defined Deathly Hallows as a holy place of death, and furthermore believe it is where Harry's parents are buried. I'm confident that the final battle between Harry and Voldemort will take place at Lily and James Potter's grave, where Harry will be driven to kill Voldemort due to the love he can generate from being with his parents. I hope you like what I think. Bye! Pickles!
I don't know about that. I mean, it's pure speculation. I think it would be cool to have it end where it began, but I don't think necessarily it's going to. I think it's just a... I don't know, a long stretch to actually say where the final battle is going to take place. But I do think it would be pretty cool to have it, you know, end where it began.
Definitely. Godric's Hollow seems like a likely place where it happened. But the thing about hallowed ground, you know, holy ground, I think that would be one of the holiest places they could probably go to, is his parents' grave. But... another holy place. I mean, we don't really know.
And you also have to remember, what do you think would have brought Harry to that place, besides maybe a Horcrux? You know, like, is Voldemort really going to meet Harry there, or is it somewhat unlikely that will occur?
I think we all can agree that Harry's going to have to be the one he's going to be the one playing
instigator.
The game this time.
Because, exactly. He's
because
the one.
Before, he was the one always getting suckered in, so he's going to have to be so prepared that he's the one, like you said,
and that's why I'm saying. Exactly, and is it likely that Voldemort would be at Harry's parents' grave?
Well, he's going to have to lure him there if that's where he wants to have the battle.
That's true, he could.
And though gathering the motivation, I think that... you know, saving the Wizarding World is going to pump Harry up enough to motivate him to try to finally kill Voldemort once and for all. But I guess I see what she means. How it could, if it's a significant place, that means personal to him. It's very personal to him. You know, sort of, am I going to let Voldemort kill me on my own parents' grave? He's not going to let that happen. So
I don't think there's a
Sorry, Micah?
Go ahead, Micah.
I was going to say, do you guys think he'd go there more than once in the book? Because he says at the end of Half-Blood Prince that he's going to Godric's Hollow, so we would expect him to go there at the beginning of the seventh book.
Well,
unless he gets delayed.
Either that or if he's trying to lure Voldemort into a trap. I mean, it's a good place
to
lure him.
I mean, maybe there's something special about Godric's Hollow.
About the place, exactly.
Maybe there's magic still there.
Well, it's a question, because apparently Hogsmeade is the only wizard establishment, only all-wizard establishment in Britain or whatever, and that really leaves the question, Godric's Hollow. Are there muggles in Godric's Hollow? Or being in Godric's Hollow, if you happen to be the heir of Godric Gryffindor, if that's what the name reference is Godric's Hollow somehow different or special for you if you are the heir of Gryffindor? And you know, if that's true, is Harry the heir of Gryffindor? Is Ron, whatever. But I don't think he's going to be there more than once or twice, and I think it's very unlikely that Voldemort will have a Horcrux in Godric's Hollow, because Voldemort had to go to Godric's Hollow. You know, think of the context. Voldemort was only in Godric's Hollow because he found out that that's where the Potters were hiding. And once he was dead, there was no opportunity
to
place a Horcrux. Yeah. Well, not just create a Horcrux, but to actually place a Horcrux somewhere in Godric's Hollow. I think it's very unlikely that he would have done that.
And by the way, J.K. Rowling said on her website that Harry is not the heir of Gryffindor.
Okay, so that's fine, but what I was trying to establish is the place. You know, the place. Is the place special? If Hogsmeade is the only wizard establishment, the only all-wizard establishment, what is Godric's Hollow? You know, what is it really?
Isn't Godric's Hollow where the snitch was invented or something like that?
I have not read my copy of Quidditch Through the Ages for a year now, so I could not tell you.
Quidditch was invented in near Queerditch Marsh or something, but I don't remember about the snitch.
Well, thanks, Emma, for that email. Love the accent. I love Australians. Keith Urban, give a shout-out. We have one more voicemail. This one comes from Melissa from Illinois.
Hey, this is Melissa from Illinois. I was just wondering what you guys thought about the nice dress robes being graduation robes. And maybe that does imply that the end battle or adventure will be, you know, in June at the end of the school year.
I don't think Harry's going to be graduating from Hogwarts.
I don't think so
personally,
either.
But...
Well, why would it be...
I guess that would make sense.
Why would it take place at Hogwarts? Just because they have the robes on doesn't mean it's at Hogwarts. You know?
That's true. And she was saying that it might be graduation robes?
No, I think...
Well, no, that's a question.
They could be from the wedding. That was my initial thought. You know, they're all dressed up from Bill and Fleur's wedding.
Yeah, you're right. That's...
Yeah. They're just at a wedding, and then all of a sudden they get swept into the world of Narnia. Or I mean, Gringotts, whatever.
I don't know. You see, with a lot of these voicemails that we get, we can't exactly say.
Definitively,
that seems. I mean, yeah, that does seem realistic, but I don't know. Well, actually, I guess it kind of doesn't seem realistic, because I don't think Harry's going to be at any type of graduation. But and do they even have graduation?
We don't know, because we've never seen.
Or they just send them on their way.
Yeah, every year,
and Harry is not dressed the same.
Every year, students from Hogwarts graduate. And, you know, year sevens all graduate, but yet the only time we've seen year sevens or whoever leave school is to actually quit. You know, Fred and George's exit, that's the only thing. But graduation happens every year, so is there a ceremony? Is there a graduation? But then again, at the end of every year is usually when all the crap goes down, or when all the stuff goes down, that allows Dumbledore to cancel final exams and for all these large school dramas to happen. So,
convenient, huh?
Yeah, convenient. So maybe it's true that the past 6 years nobody's graduated Hogwarts, or everyone's graduated but they haven't had a ceremony just because of all the stuff that Harry Potter gets himself into.
Wow.
That's a good point. Good point, Eric. Well, that wraps up this week's voicemails. If you have... We'll get to some contact information a little bit later in the show, but remember you can send those in to us by calling, Skyping the name MuggleCast in the U.S. Call 1-800-1866. Wait, never mind. No, I lied. 1-2-8-20-MAGIC. Now, before we wrap up the show this week, we have a chicken soup for the MuggleCast listener's soul. This comes from Brittany, age 16, from California. Quote, "Hey, MuggleCasters. Recently, my grandmother was diagnosed with brain cancer. Because of all the radiation and medication, she has been losing memory and becoming very confused. She's extremely off, and she now has to live with us. Every day I have to make sure she gets up, eats, and take her where I go when I can. Balancing that, school, track, and volleyball every day has made me go crazy. The only way I could find time to relax was to listen to you guys. You make me laugh and just get on with the day. Whenever I begin to get all stressed out, I just listen to one of the episodes and I feel much better. I just want to thank you guys for doing this show and keeping me sane. I love all of you. Thank you so much. Brittany." Well, I'm glad we can help you out, Brittany. I know what it's like to have relatives sick. I'm sure some of the other hosts do too. So it's good that we can help you get you through your day. If you have an inspiring situation or inspiring story in which MuggleNet or MuggleCast has helped you out, go ahead and send us an email. Before we wrap up this week's show, we have some contact information for you. You can email us at mugglecast@staff.mugglenet.com or each of the hosts' first name at staff.mugglenet.com, or you can use the contact form on the website. We have some numbers for you to call and leave a voicemail. If you live in the United States, please dial 1-218-20-MAGIC. If you live in the United Kingdom, call 020-8144-0677. And if you live in Australia, call 02-8003-5668. And, oh, yes, you can catch them many other places out there. I can't say it like Andrew. I haven't been doing this as long as he has. Let's see here. MySpace, Facebook, YouTube, Frapper, Last.fm, Fantasy Forums. Dig the show at dig.com. Vote for us once a month at Podcast Alley. And rate and review us at Yahoo Podcasts.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
That's pretty darn good, Ben.
Don't forget about the P.O. Box, Ben.
Oh, don't forget about the P.O. Box. P.O. Box 223, Moundedge, Kansas, 67107. Send us anything, any type of parcel mail.
And then I have one announcement from Andrew. He just he gave a listener rebuttal, or not a listener rebuttal, a listener challenge out on last week's show, and he said the results will be on episode 91. So, for those people wondering.
Guys, we're 90.
We're old.
It's crazy how time flies.
You know, we're going to think of something really cool for our 100th show. Wow. We have to. We have to do something really cool for our 100th show.
Well, we have 10 episodes, too.
Not to state the obvious.
Yeah,
10 episodes to plan it. So.
If you have any cool ideas for a 100th show, go ahead and send those bad boys in. Well, it's been a fun ride. I hope you learned a little bit more about what's Deathly Hallows and all that stuff. But I think that does it for us this week on episode 90. I'm Ben Ching.
I'm Kevin Steck.
I'm Eric Skull.
I'm Micah Tannenbaum.
And I'm Mikey B.
That does it for us. Check back next week for episode 91. Have a good week, people.
Andrew here, using the magic of editing to insert myself into this week's show. As we told everyone last week, Jamie was at EA Studios a few weeks ago to conduct some interviews with the folks making the great new Order of the Phoenix video game. And for the next few weeks, we're going to air a few of those interviews, and here is part one right now.
So, my name's Wayne. I'm the role here, of course, CG supervisor on our game team. So I'll try to work out the best way to describe it to you. Have you guys met Kelvin yet?
Not yet.
So when you meet Kelvin, who's the art director for the game, it's probably a little bit easier to explain what I do by explaining what he does. He defines the style of artwork for the game, you know, whether or not Hogwarts is going to be a lot of set at night or dark or a certain colour palette or things like this. He defines pretty much what he wants the game artwork to look like. My job is then to deliver that artwork into the game, to work with the art teams and make sure they do. And my job is sort of a mixture of art and technology, basically. So when you meet some of the world guys that build the worlds, like Simon and stuff like that, the tools that they use to build stuff, I help work with them to make sure they've got those tools in place. And that really what we're ending up with inside the game is what Kelvin see. sort of a nutshell. I also, then work with all the producers and production to make sure that they're on target. I work with that game's engineers, who then have to, like, obviously write the code to make the stuff play at 30 frames. And I get to sit as a balancing act between all the different worlds that are trying to, of people that are trying to put stuff into the game and trying to make the game run. I just sort of work between them all to perspective on what we're delivering, on what we actually make sure we're also pushing the bounds of what we do. Means I have a great job because I get to sort of like push what we can get into the game, and it means that sometimes I have a tough job because it means I have to say, well, unfortunately we can't get into the games. You know what, if we had our way we would make this game for years and years and years, and we would keep on adding stuff into it, and unfortunately we got it at some point. So I have to try and keep a bit of perspective. I don't know if it explains what I do terribly well, but it's
okay, so over to you guys, really, to ask some questions, really.
It's very impressive for a fan who doesn't know how these things are done to sort of, you know, watch the first video and see Hogwarts in all its glory. Can you describe sort of the process from, you start off with, I assume, a sort of stencil drawing of Hogwarts, do you? It's your job to turn that into the computer thing.
Absolutely. So, I think the process that we use is not so different to what architectural or design firms in that days as well, where they will typically say if you're going to build a building, you're someone going to come and you build a building, and you're going to spend a lot of money on building that building. Typically, what happens, you'll hire an architect, they'll draw blueprints and design layouts, and then they'll normally do a computer mock-up for you that you'll go through, and then they'll refine that. They might put like little trees and stuff to get you a really good sense as to what's going on. We actually go through a really similar process. The difference is we got our blueprints from the set designers and from Warner Brothers and that ourselves. We basically, they've done all that work, that they've mapped out, they had interpreted what, I guess, J.K. Rowling's vision of what these rooms would look like, etc., and they put blueprints for their sets. So we took that, and what we did is we built basic mock-up layouts of those. So it was like all the rooms, all the corridors, the outside, the courtyards, the boathouse, the common rooms, etc., except they were just done as like grey and blue architectural drawings. Everything was to scale inside those rooms, the doorways where they were supposed to be, but there was no dressing on them, there was no texture on them, they were just grey. That gets us our starting point because that lays out Hogwarts for us. Obviously Hogwarts is a really big part of our game, so that gave us a place. And what was really great with that, really early on, we could walk through Hogwarts. It sort of looked like you were walking through an architect's blueprint, so it looked, felt a little bit odd, but everything was where it was supposed to be. And where that's also really important is it meant that we could start to lay out gameplay into those rooms, we could start to set up our cameras into those rooms, and we could sort a lot, you know, 1001 technically. One of the fantastic things about our games is we have what we call really no streaming, it's fully streamed, so we have no loading zones. What's neat about that is that you can walk from the blueprint boathouse to the Owlery, and you don't see a loading screen. That's kind of cool inside a game. It's pretty damn cool inside a game. PS2, it's almost unheard of.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen just by magic, obviously. There's a lot of very boring details into how we actually achieve that. And by setting up Hogwarts in a very low-resolution fashion, that enabled us to do that. What it meant then is also those blueprints could go off to our world artists and things like that, and they could then start to actually model all the detail into those. But they had a very accurate blueprint of what the room... That's kind of the process that it went through, sort of like, got the blueprint, did the mock-up, start to build, and then everything just... It's sort of like just gets built, you know, the whole game just builds up effectively on top of it.
So at what stage do you sort of completely abandon drawing and, you know, manual stuff and you move all that after you've got the blueprints?
So from the, as we get each blueprint for each room, we will immediately start building a computer mock-up of it at that point in time. And the game will exist as grayscale. If you've seen the game, if you'd walked through the game, say, 3 months ago, you would have seen a lot of it would have been all lit and textured, but you still would have walked into rooms that looked just like three-dimensional blueprints, effectively. So we built the entire castle out of these blueprints, and then we just built up each section of it.
And how does it work for sort of the owls or, you know, the characters? Or
How do we build
like
those?
Yeah.
So they go through a really slightly different process. We sort of get them drip-fed to us throughout the year. Typically, particularly if it's a new character inside the movie, we have to wait until we get stills of them. And, you know, some of the older characters like Harry, etc., we know what they're going to look like. So the biggest thing we have to wait on is well, what uniform might he be wearing this year, or what changes might the movie have made to him this year that we recognise? Newer characters that appear in the movie that we've never, you know, seen before, we have to wait to get photographic reference, etc., off Warner Brothers. And also, they're great. They give us a lot of... They help us out a lot, you know, like that. So we sort of wait for that to come through from there. And then we just build them up. But they're built to a relatively high resolution right from the word go. We don't sort of sketch them out. We just build them as quickly as we can. We don't have time to a large extent. Otherwise, we have an awful lot of characters in this game. I can't remember the exact last, a huge amount. So as soon as we get the stuff, we just build it.
I wonder if you wouldn't mind actually taking how different from video games and what could be quite an interesting...
Yeah, my background is I've been at Electronic Arts for coming on to about 2.5, coming up to 3 years. Before that, I worked in the movie industry for a very long time. I worked for a company in New Zealand called Weta.
Who did Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, I worked on the Lord of the Rings films. Actually, I actually worked out at Weta for a very long time before Lord of the Rings. I left there at hours into another movie company called PDI DreamWorks, and Rec 2 with them, and decided to move into the gaming industry. And I moved into the gaming industry because it got kind of interesting. And I'd always played a lot of games. I mean, game back. But I thought with the next generation hardware, I thought, and things like that, Xbox 360, PS3, I thought it was going to become kind of interesting. As it turns out, I discovered that I actually care less about that. I don't actually care about Xbox 360s. I don't care about PS3s. What I discovered, which is what I probably always knew, is that it's like anything in life. What actually really matters is what you're working on. I actually just really enjoy working on Harry Potter movies. I'm just, you know, I like the books and stuff like that. You know, I'm a bit of a... I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan and you know, a lot of other science fiction type fan. I'm also a very big Harry Potter type fan. So the more I got into making games, the more fun it just became, the actual process of just making a game. And you know what? Making a Harry Potter game is a pretty cool thing to be able to do.
Yeah.
And like, to me, probably making a war game or something wouldn't be so interesting, but I just happen to like... the fact is I love castles as well. And you know, Harry Potter is great, but it's one of the great things about moving to England, of course, is all of Europe, you have these great castles here. There's a fantastic one here in Guildford. But I got to, I get to make castles. So sort of moving here, but I don't see it as being that much of a difference between working inside a movie and working inside a game. We're both just trying to entertain people. Two different ways of doing it. You know, one's a game, an interactive thing, one's a movie. They sat for 2.5 hours, whatever, inside a movie. But it's all about, just really trying to bring the best entertainment to somebody, ultimately what our jobs are. Try and do. Answered your question.
Thank you.
Yes. Do we have anything else?
One thing I was going to ask about, the some of the things like water and grass and the trees react brilliantly to the elements and the thing, like, you know, the grass sways in the wind, so do the trees, and the water looks like it's, you know, shimmering. How do you achieve...
So, the best way I can answer that, sort of like, the grass and the trees, they actually, for those, you'll notice that they don't do that on, like, the PS2, and they only do that on the Xbox 360 and on the PS3s. They just simply take advantage of the graphics hardware that's inside you. And what that graphics hardware enables me to do is, if I create a model like this with a lot, you know, with the texture of a branch on it, what I can do is that model is made up, of a number of little points. And what I can do in real time is I can actually move those points around. So when you see those things shimmering, all I'm doing, it's like everything in life. It's like everything from an illusionist on stage to a visual effect to in games. It's just an optical trick. And so it just moves those things around. And if you want to get all, if you can remember to your mathematics, it's a sine wave. I don't know whether you guys are into your mathematics at all, but if you remember the sine wave, I can't really remember it very much, I have to cast one, but it basically does this. And if you have a look at it, that's what our branch is. And we adjust the speed and we adjust things like this of it, but it just moves around. And like everything, we try to put it in there so that we don't draw attention to it. It's just part of it. The water is done very simply, very similarly, and that it's just a bunch of optical illusions. We sort of know what a reflection should look like to your eye, so we cheat things to give you that impression of it. And we, yeah, it's like everything that we do has to be a cheat because, you know, in the real world, God has a bit of an easier type of time in that he's got infinite computing power to make these things look great. So we have to do our best facsimile of that, our best adaptation of that. And incidentally, a lot of the tricks that we use for doing that is very similar to identical to what you would do in visual effects. Like, so the same sort of like processes, way that it's common across. It's more common across the industries than people.
With the game that obviously you've seen today, those kind of little touch add to the kind of like ambience of the world and that whole experience as well. And it's all those kind of little details that add together to really give you such an immersive experience as well.
And I can honestly tell you, in the next Potter games that will come out after this, you will see more and more of that inside that. We spent a lot of time on this game trying to build up Hogwarts and things like that. And for me now, when I play through the game, I think, man, I want to add this to it, I want to add this to it, I want to just continue to dress that world. So as we've learned more of how to do that, we'll just continue to add those background details.
And I think that was kind of what Harvey was saying earlier, that, you know, if we could, we'd sit there and add more and more and more to the game, and, you know, timelines and milestones would go out the window. But,
absolutely.
You know, so this is where, you know, these sort of things that are being learned along the way will kind of go into the next game. So, you know, that will progress like that. Okay? You carry on, Jamie.
I just want to ask you, this is more a personal sort of interest. Where do you think, with these next generation consoles, where do you see computer, video game graphics going? What's going to happen next? You know, we have the realism. I think it's just going to keep getting more realistic.
You know, I sort of don't know. I think it is a good question, and I honestly don't know the answer to there. It's sort of, a lot of people search for the holy grail of photorealism. I don't see the point. And the reason why I don't see the point is the point of a gaming console is not to make something photorealistic. The point of a gaming console is to give somebody a great game that they can play and have enjoyed. Now, the style of the game might push that towards realism, but I don't think every game needs to follow. Yeah, I play games like Viva Pinata and stuff like that on the 360, which are all photorealistic, but I enjoy them. I think we'll push towards... We will definitely push towards going more realistic. We'll push towards making our characters look and talk and act more realistic. But the purpose of that is not just to make them look realistic for their own sake. It's to try and immerse you in the game more. It's going to be all for gameplay's sake is the only reason why we would do that. If I wanted to do something just to make something look realistic as I could, I'd go and buy a camera. Film it. And if it isn't helping out the game and making the game look better, and in our case, making our world of Harry Potter look better, it's very much my own personal opinion as well. You'll hear a dozen different, you know, people would, I know people that would probably hang me up for saying that, but it is just personal opinions. It's sort of what I look for. I enjoyed making Shrek 2 very, not at all photorealistic as much as I did, I say, work on Lord of the Rings or something like that.
Hey.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thank you so much, man. So
I'm a game designer on Harry Potter, and my job is I work really closely with Matt because he's kind of a creative director, and what I do is I work through the whole story of the game, plotted out all the missions, Matt works out what the gameplay was, works on all the gameplay mechanics, like the magic, how you do that, how he moves, and basically turned the story into get the levels that you have, and then what my job then with, from that point on is to go through the game and work with all the other designers and the programmers and the artists, make sure that everything that we started with is what we get and also lays well and help implement. Kind of an ongoing job, and now at the end I'm just playing the game and making sure that it's what it to be and solve all the problems basically.
How many hours of testing do you think go into it's done?
Well, we have about 5 embedded testers on the team, and then we have, I think, about 70 or 80 and also we have languages as well, so make sure they're correct. So, hundreds of hours.
It's a great deal of people.
Hundreds of hours, yeah. Working shifts towards the end of the game, you have people just come 24-hour shifts.
Did you literally...
They don't work 24 hours.
Yeah.
You have different groups. That would be draconian. That would be bad. So, you know, you've got people working a normal day, and then when they get home, somebody works a night shift. So,
do you have to see every single thing in the game? Every single thing viable you need to
play? Oh, yeah, exactly. And we have to be able to tell Warner Brothers and Christopher Little Agency exactly what everything is, so yeah. They know that we're not doing anything crazy like Harry Potter robot. You know, we don't want that. We have to make sure that everything said it would be.
And how do you choose missions for the game? Is it you and Matt sort of, you know, think what will be best for the game for the people who play it?
Yes, we do that. But then the other thing that we do is we get very early access to the movie scripts, so that gives us a really good idea of how they've broken down the story, so what they think is important in the movie helps us sort of figure out where to put our emphasis. It's not an exact science, because that changes a lot. We get lots of different, but Warners are great. I mean, they you know, give us a lot of support, so we get to see a lot of stuff like the concept art and stuff early on, so we can kind of get an idea of what things are going to be, so we can work out. Well, I mean, the first pass you do is you pick out all of the major story points, figure out what gameplay you want to do in those. And then you also have to think about a whole unified gameplay. So how is the game going to play from start to finish? Because you don't want Harry doing the player to learn a new thing every 5 minutes. They never will, they'll just forget. Yeah. So you have to have a set system that you can figure that out. And we have stuff like, we looked at the DA and saw really good structure. So if a Marie opened all the missions, there's sort of character's personality who's giving you the...
Choose the sort of... gameplay after the art mock-up is done of world, or do you sort of do them
before, after, and during? Because the game gets designed on paper. We do lots of video prototypes of us pretending to write things, and you know, we build models, do all that, and then the art starts going in, and you see something, hang on, look like that, that's really cool, we could do this.
Yeah.
You know, wow, that fountain's really cool, we need to figure out a way that we can turn it on and off. You know, it's a constant process, I think.
Favourite part of the game?
I really like the bit I showed you earlier where Draco is goading Ron about Hagrid being taken away, and then Ron loses it, tries to cast a spell at Draco, Draco blocks it, and then it just all dissolves into a big massive scrap.
It all heats up.
Yeah, I really like that. And I love Dumbledore versus Voldemort.
Yeah.
Because likely you're not going to get the chance to play that again. I like that.
What do you think is different, or have you tried to do different in this game, going to appeal to?
Well, I think what we've done is we've looked at the audience that we make this game for, which is Harry Potter fans primarily, and we've tried not to make a super hardcore game experience, like because we need to really appeal to a broad audience, but we want to make it incredibly rich in content. We don't want to make a really easy game where you can see everything in 5 minutes,
yeah.
But we want to make a game that isn't frustrating, it has literally tons of stuff to do. Initially they feel as if they've got, you know, too much to do, which I think is really good, and then they can just play it at their own pace. I think if you look at previous Harry Potter games, they're very puzzle orientated, very linear, just bang 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 bang, and also they maybe drift a little too far from the story, and so I think with this one we stick really close and we set out to do Hogwarts. I think that's what we...
Guys,
any questions?
No. Could you possibly just go into a little bit more detail about how you work with Matt?
Sure.
And probably your kind of thoughts on the Potter franchise as well, and how you kind of got into it and what you thought. So if you can start with the Matt bit and then do
sure.
The how you feel about Harry afterwards, that would be good.
So one of the cool things is I get on really well with Matt. Before I did Harry Potter, I worked on a series of games called Burnout. So I did those for 6 years, and I've always been a big Harry Potter fan, and I've sort of done enough, and I spoke to Matt and he's like, yeah, we'll work on Harry Potter, you know, we'll work together. And I'm like, that's, yeah, all right, and I'll do that, that sounds awesome. And then, you know, it's we work really closely. So basically what we do is we draw out the timeline of the story initially at the start, and we'll both just throw around ideas, disagree, argue over points, you know, and just say, okay, that would make a really cool mission, but he would be in that. No, he wouldn't do that. And, you know, Matt, his knowledge of the fiction is very large, and you know, mine is pretty big, and we end up having quite a few sort of heated discussions about what goes in and what doesn't. And we try and sort of, out geek each other, which is, you know, always fun. And then once we've done that, we should kind of work out how we want to break it down into prototypes. So, say, for instance, with the spells and the fighting, we actually filmed each other. With like loads of us doing spell gestures to see what they would look like, and because we're dealing with people, so we may as well film people. And then we filled corridors with people and watched what would happen if somebody walked down the corridor, and how people would react. Because if you look in the game, when you're playing it, you probably didn't notice it because it's really subtle. But the people in the corridor would look at Harry as you walk past, and they would do that. You think about somebody like Harry, he's really famous. He is famous in the school. So if you walk past, people would look at him and comment. So we looked at that and did lots of prototype stuff for that, which is really cool. And then we worked very closely with the artists to try and figure out how Hogwarts would fit together. So initially we did, with some of the other designers, we built a map, a load of boxes for the locations, so how it would all locate together. So then we lived with that for quite a long time. So then I could say, okay, to get to Dada, you go out of the common room, you go down to the third floor, you go down the third floor corridor, cross the suspension bridge up the Dada Tower, and you're in Dada. Yeah. But if you want to, you go down out of the Dada Tower onto the second floor corridor, down into the Herbology corridor, and then so we knew exactly where everything was, and so we built the map in our heads. So then the artists also lived with it. Then when they were building it, they knew how Hogwarts was built. And then we looked at things like little windings. We wanted to have a big opening, so we wanted to have little. We didn't want it to be long. We just wanted to have like a big moment where the Dementors attack, like the movie does. Almost like that bit of the Bond movie, you know, where you have like the pre-credit sequence and, you know, the action scene. Knew that the fans would think Grimmauld Place was cool, but we also needed a place where we could teach the player all the basics, being the right place to do it, because Ron is always struggling with his spells, and Ginny is younger, and Hermione is, you know, always ready to teach. Yeah. And also Harry at that point is a little bit nervous about using magic because of the trial. So the upcoming trial, so it just seemed like a really logical point where Harry would get back on the horse. Because one of the things we have to deal with every Potter game is we have to teach the player how to use spells that Harry actually, fictionally,
knows already.
Yeah. So we have to always come up with some sort of reasonable way of doing that. And then we go back at Christmas to a place for no other reason than for the fans. Yeah. Loads of fan stuff, so you can find some things that are going to be important. And, you know, you can look at the Black family tree. Arthur Weasley's there after the X-Play lines, and you just get to walk around, just as guests that, you know, guys would want to walk around the place. And then there you can leave whenever you want. And basically, we've set it up so it cranks it up to 11. So Umbridge's, the missions get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then bites get bigger and bigger. And then once you get to the Ministry of Magic, it's, you get to play as Sirius, and you get to play as Dumbledore. The fight Voldemort with Occlumency.
You mentioned you worked on other games.
Yes.
Burnout. How does the Harry Potter experience sort of differ from every other games? Are there any sort of...
I think there's a lot of similarities in the way games are made, but one thing I really love about working on Harry Potter is it's a really specific audience. You know who you're making the game for. I think one thing games is sometimes game developers can be a little selfish and make the game for themselves. And I think it was really nice to have as much contact with the people who buy the game. Speaking to you guys has been really good, and loads of focus testing and stuff. All the way through this game, we've had kids of various ages in playing the game. And that, for me, is great, because designer have to react to what people want.
I think that's input into that terms of us constantly forums. I mean, I think that's best that every single person in here, what's happening on the fan site forums, and, you know, and early on in the process as well, about what we wanted, what you guys wanted in the game. And a lot of it as well was kind of validation, because at a lot of points we kind of like had an idea of what was going in, but it was just really great to see what was coming up on the forums, what people wanted, and be able to check it back and go, yeah, we're on the right track. We know we're on the right track. This is what people want. We really believe that we're really on track to deliver something that, you know, what people are after.
It would have been really, really worrying if we'd gone onto the fan site. Nothing we were doing was on there. It's like, oh, no. But it was like the case of, yes, we think we're in the right place. But just going back to what you said earlier, working on other games, forums for games in general are usually bitter, twisted, nasty places. Whereas, you know, this has been an entirely useful, you know, the use of forums, like, you know, we look at just great feedback, basically. It's not positive, and it's helpful, and it's just great.
And a lot of the postings were actually really constructive as well, weren't they? Really, really constructive. Like you said, there was no kind of negativity, nastiness. It was all like, people really genuinely wanted to help. Yeah, absolutely.